Yvette Rodriguez, I'll be moderating the panel today. Today's panel discussion, and events that are happening after the discussion, is all connected to protecting sacred places. And so before we begin, I would like to invite one of our elders here in L.A. Please welcome Gloria from the Tongva Nation. Discuss sacred sites. I'm just going to run through the files that I have. I don't think they were necessarily to be in this order, so I'm just going to run through some brief excerpts from each panelist's bios. First on the list, and when I say your name, you can just please raise your hand. And we're going to give each panelist 5 minutes to share your thoughts, your critique, your analysis. Of whatever issue you're dealing with in terms of the sacred site. And after we run through the panelists tonight, we will open it up for a discussion with the rest of the group. So let's start from the top. I have Alberta Nels. Alberta Now's has worked with youth of the Peaks to mobilize youth to successfully oppose the development of the Arizona Snowball Ski Resort on the San Francisco Peaks, held sacred by over 13 Native American nations. Alberta has also organized demonstrations and marches to protect this and other sacred sites from development while making public her concern for the survival of traditional culture. Next we have Rebecca Robles. Rebecca Robles is from the, and I don't want to mess this up, Ahashaman? All right, got it. Ahashaman Nation. Rebecca has followed in the footsteps of her mother, Lillian Robles, and has been working to protect Ahashaman's sacred sites for over 7 years. She and her family organized and led the annual Ancestor Walk, a pilgrimage to Ahashaman sacred sites throughout Orange County that was founded by her mother in 1996. Cindy Alvitra? So Cindy Alvitra has been director of the Tiat Society since its inception in the late 1980s. She is Tomba, descendant of the Mupatam Saltwater Clan. She is currently a PhD candidate in the Department of World Arts and Culture, specializing in folklore, traditional medicine, and California Indians. Next we have Carrie Long. Is Carrie Long on the panel? She is not.
Not here.
She is not here, okay. And then next, and I definitely don't want to mess up. I'm gonna say your last name, you can help me with your first name. Kilcher. Come on, give it to me again, bro. Corianka. You guys actually got mics too. Corianka Kilcher. Corianka Kilcher is an actress and global youth ambassador for Amnesty International and Amazon Watch, and is the founder of the On Cue Initiative, an environmental and human rights youth organization. She is also a speaker at the United Nations on the panel on indigenous human rights and is a voice for several international indigenous youth organizations. Next we have Tetzosomoc. Tetzosomoc was an elected representative of the South Central Farmers for a period of over 3 years as they struggled to save the South Central Farm. As the farm struggle has evolved, Tetzosomoc continues to play an organizing role in helping to shape the direction and recomposition of the South Central Farmers. Now, I know I didn't go through everybody, and that's all the bios that I have. Do we have any more? If I didn't mention your name, please grab the mic and partake in my job. Don't be afraid. It's okay, Western culture thing. Mike. Mike.
Hi, my name is Daryl Molina, and I'm the Youth Program Coordinator at Communities for a Better Environment, and we are a local environmental justice organization here organizing in Southeast Los Angeles in the communities of Wilmington.
Hello, my name is Angela Mooney-DRC, and I'm also from the Ahashaman Nation. Rebecca Robles and I are co-coordinators for the United Coalition of Tekmahe, which is a grassroots coalition of Ahashaman people dedicated to protecting our sacred site and stopping the 241 South toll road from being built through Orange County.
Let's begin this, because you know we're definitely going to probably be running over time. Let's start off with Angela. We're just going to run down like this. Is that okay? We can start on the left. The left. The left.
Okay. I'm only going to talk for a couple minutes about kind of the legal aspect of what's happening with Pane, and then I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca, who's my elder, both in years, just a few, but also definitely in experience in terms of doing sacred site protection for our tribe's sacred sites. Basically, the issue that we have and the reason we formed the United Coalition to Protect Pane in June of 2007 was because of the threat of this toll road that would be built through San Onofre State Beach. The toll road would come within feet of one of our burial grounds. It would really virtually destroy our ability to practice ceremony and engage in traditional cultural practices. It'd be a six-lane highway going right up against the site. It would destroy, be environmentally devastating. It would be devastating to the water quality. So many of our community members came together and, you know, we decided we can't let this happen. And no matter what political differences we may have internally among our community, the protection of our sacred sites is important enough for us to rise above this. I also have afterwards, I can hand it out or have it sitting somewhere. We have sample letters. The main fight we're gearing up for right now is the California Coastal Commission hearing, which will be February 6th, 7th, or 8th in San Diego. So any of you folks that are in the LA area, we'd love to get your contact information. We'd love to see you at that hearing. We need a lot of people to come out and show that we support Plan B and say that you can't move a village, but you can move a road. So I'll turn it over to Rebecca.
So much change, you know, so much an acceleration of the growth, and just total lack of regard for the earth as a resource that is not renewable. And then also how difficult it is to get across to mainstream society that the land is how we spiritually renew ourselves. And that if everything is built on, if everything is paved over, that we will cease to exist because we can't spiritually renew ourselves. The road that Angela is talking about, even by the TCA is the name of the developer. It's a transportation corridor agency, and it's a quasi-private corporation. And even by their own study, that road won't solve the traffic problems. And the plan is it will be a six-lane highway. They'll dig down 30 feet. And, you know, because that whole area, the whole valley, was a place where the people lived. And they lived there for many years, for thousands of years. So I'm sure that there will be disruption if the road is built, and unearthing of ancestors. And so we formed, initially my mother, you know, worked to preserve that site, worked with the Sierra Club. We formed Sierra Club Sacred Sites Task Force, the Native American Heritage Commission, the Attorney General filed a lawsuit for the Native American Heritage Commission because that site is registered sacred site. It's a traditional cultural property, and it's a place where we did reburials. This road that they're talking about, it will be within, like Angela said, 15 feet away, and so it would be like us standing, and the cars will be going by 15 feet away. They'll build huge pilings too, and at that site, the road will go across. And they can't understand how it will destroy the essence of the site. So I think it's so important that we support each other. You know, what happens here in this court in Pasadena is going to it's going to impact all of us. It's going to set precedents. So I thank you for coming out and supporting this coalition, and I know that like the only way that we are going to be successful in preserving these sites is by supporting these coalitions throughout the country.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Oh, jeez, what a start. The United States, I didn't know that was an authentic entity. I thought it was just this elusive thing that was made up by these white guys with wooden teeth. United States of America.
I've been lied to?
Yes. It doesn't exist. That's why we have to practice sovereignty. And not the sovereignty that the United States of this place, have imposed into the minds of Indigenous people. As a Tongva person, and I thank my elder, Gloria, and I welcome all my family, my community, and all of you to this session tonight, and it's very appropriate and my obligation to honor my ancestors, our ancestors, as we are in our traditional land base, which is all of Los Angeles County. We share Orange County with the Ohachina, and the four Southern Channel Islands, including San Nicolas, Santa Catalina Island, Santa Barbara, and San Clemente. We've been in a struggle, as they have, for many, many years. Post-World War II created this exponential growth, the development in this land, but even prior to that, our sacred land, our ancestor, that's our relative, has been violated and destroyed. If people want to know what the consequences of all these actions are, look to us. We're non-federally recognized people. We're the descendants, we're the survivors, we're the descendants of the survivors of the genocide, the unacknowledged genocide of this country. When you see us, all of us here, we exist in the midst of the urban areas. We're considered to be extinct. And our people have suffered through a lot. So when it comes to these issues, we come to support our Diné, our Apache, our Hopi brothers and sisters for the protection of the San Francisco Peaks. As Gloria had mentioned, our elder, we're in a present struggle trying to protect the Kuwunga, which is a place of our emergence as human beings. It's now the last 23 acres of undeveloped area is at Cal State Long Beach, and we will not be able to be here, Stacy Thompson and myself, to continue supporting physically and directly to this cause, because right now we're just trying to get 73 ancestors reburied. Reburial, something we didn't do. Reburial ceremonies aren't something we did before. Now we're forced to do it. Southern California tribes, especially those first contact tribes, the ones that took the initial blows for the inland tribes, were in a constant state of mourning. We're always having to rebury our ancestors. It's a tragedy. Yesterday I was out at the beach. I love earthquakes. I love natural disasters because it shows people who really is the boss. And I was interviewed by Channel 5 as the big waves were out there, and I said, I love these kind of things happening. I said, it's about time people learned who's in charge. I don't think they put it on TV. But as I was sitting on the beach, I started to cry. Tears come so easy as we get older, too, as we really see the loss that we've had. And just the realization that, you know, it's not just about the land. The land is us. You can't sever us from the land. You can't sever our consciousness from the land. And this is what's been going on and on and on in our people, all Indigenous people. This is our biggest struggle. And to be able to put up a facade right now as we're in a global crisis because of overconsumption in this country at the cost of our land, and to create these silly things called green movements, you know, again, at the cost of our Mother Earth, is just inappropriate. We have many, many struggles, and we also ask for your support. When Playa Vista was happening, there was over 400 of our ancestors that were yanked out of the ground. Playa Vista development got reimbursement of several million dollars under Mello Ruz to support their infrastructure. They put in a drainage ditch and destroyed 7,000-year-old cemetery. And this happens all the time with all of us. We are close to our village site of Yangna, that's in northern Los Angeles, Chinatown. Became ultimately, historically, a refugee site. So if people are feeling pain over there, you know, there's a reason. The legacy of refugeeism continues. And at Pavona, the gathering of the people, that continues also. And as always, there's so much to share with all of you about, you know, as my sister Olivia Chumasad always says, we're all human beings in training right now, and we need to stand together and support each other, because it's not about us. It's about our ancestors, and it's about all those little babies that are out there. They need to learn. They need to be close to their. That's our life. So I'll leave it there.
all of you guys for coming out here tonight and say it's a big honor for me to be up here on this panel speaking to you guys all. I'm going to start off by introducing myself again. My name is Kriyanka, and it means golden eagle in my native Quechua language. I'm descendant of the Quechua and Wachicaya people of Peru. And there are many similarities our indigenous tribes share in regards to our culture and our struggles, even though that our tribes are thousands of miles apart from each other. And for me, as a young artist in this new age of film and technology, I feel it to be my great responsibility to use my public voice and the privilege of celebrity as a tool and a great chance to speak out for environmental justice. In the past 2 years, I have been dedicating all my energy to shed light and educate people about many of the devastating issues my brothers and sisters in the Amazon are facing. Some of you guys might be recognizing me from Terrence Malick's film, The New World. And I want to say this is a love story, but more importantly, it's about the beginning of the colonizations of America. And sadly, we have not learned from our past. The colonizations of America, it continues today, but it has a new name now. It's called globalization. And what multinational oil companies are doing in the Peruvian Amazon is corporate globalization and a total disrespect for the environment and human rights. And since 1970, approximately 30% of the Amazon rainforest has either been deforested or contaminated as a result of petroleum extraction. And 95% of the Amazon is slated for extractive industry development to this day. And this pattern, I have to say, is sadly being replicated all around the world. Indigenous peoples throughout the world, we sit on the front lines of industry's development expansion. They occupy the last pristine places on Earth where resources like forests, minerals, water, and genetic diversity are still abundant. And projects that exploit their lands, sacred places, natural resources, and cultures, they're often done without their consent. And many of them are still forcibly being removed from their ancestral territories. They're still being subjected to the worst forms of human rights abuse, and their sustainable ways of developing natural resources are being dismissed. And they are continuously polluting the ecosystem with devastating consequences for the environment and the local communities. And for me, having heard many stories from many Indigenous brothers and sisters all around the world through my travels, I have yet to see or hear of one Indigenous tribe benefiting from multinational or privately owned companies engaging in oil, gas, timber, uranium, gold, diamonds, and all the other natural resource exploitation and contamination on their ancestral land. So, in the case of Snow Bowl, I ask myself, why are some of us so readily willing to scrutinize things which are profitable to humanity as a whole, whereas ideas that have benefit only to a small private entity or group, they often seem to be assumed by many as more legitimate? This is happening all around the world. Mother Earth's destruction is driven by a complex web of social and economic forces of greed. The most important lesson that I have to say I've learned through many, many pressing environmental issues facing our planet today, they are not confined within borders. We all have one common need as inhabitants of this beautiful world and planet. A clean, healthy environment is key to our survival as a human race. And traditionally, indigenous peoples around the world have lived in harmony with Mother Earth, and their lifestyles are based on environmentally sustainable principles and practices without exploiting and destroying their children's future. And the struggles for indigenous peoples' cultural survival is directly connected to maintaining a healthy environment. And it just doesn't make sense to talk about global economic development and progress without talking about basic rights to lands and resources, culture and identity, and self-determination. So, in the name of development, I have to say that we have become the leaders of environmental destruction, and we seem to be oblivious to the fact that we cannot eat, drink, or breathe money or profit. Some things, they don't have a price, but they do have value. Our relationship with the environment is a necessity to progress, not an obstacle to progress. And environmental sustainability and a true commitment towards universal dignity and basic human rights is the only true form of evolution and human development, because it's up to all of us to keep the commitment to protect Mother Earth's sacred places alive and ignite it in those who have lost it. We are all responsible to plant the seed of change so all unborn generations can enjoy its shade. We are all living in a time which demands us to urgently pay attention to such things as global warming and climate change. But I want to say we are also living in a time where we all need to encourage each other to be part of the shift and the shift in climate change, and also the global warming of hearts that I'm seeing everywhere in my travels. So I want to say it's a big honor, and thank you all so much for coming here tonight again, and it really gives me hope as well. Thank you.
Hello again, my name is Alberta Nels. My traditional name is Nepah, which means a female veteran, and I use that name tonight because right now I'm in a sacred place. I'm in front of the basket, I'm in front of the corn, and I address myself as this name because right now we're in the struggle, and the spirits, when they hear my name, they know that it's their granddaughter talking. I'm of the Mexican clan, born for the Salt clan. My maternal grandfather's clan is of the Chiricahua Apache clan, and my paternal grandfather's clan is of the Folding Arms clan. I'm originally from Hard Rock, Arizona, Navajo Nation, but right now I'm residing outside the reservation in Flagstaff, and I recognize myself as a Diné female. I come here today, we arrived today from Flagstaff, and I come here with humble thoughts and humble prayers because we are in this struggle. The San Francisco Peaks, also known to Diné as Dog Osli, our western mountain, and it's just not genet souls of Dog Osli, the Bensa. So it's not on the views of Cholin that the San Francisco Peaks is our western mountain in our Diné Navajo universe in Diné Bekea. And we came here today because for too long have we been fighting the struggle. For too long have we been fighting the struggle of our homeland for us as indigenous people, that it came to the point to where we had to travel hundreds of miles because we want to protect the San Francisco Peaks. We want to protect that. And our group name, Youth of the Peaks, that's what we are. We are the youth of the peaks. That mountain, when we sing, when we pray, you hear Biyajin Nishlin, Bitsui Nishlin, we are the grandchildren. We are the children of this mountain, that we are not higher than the land because we belong to the earth. And the earth does not belong to us. So who are we as people to say that we're going to desecrate this sacred place by using reclaimed water? and by that desecration, what's going to become of the spirit of the mountain. The other presenters, the other speakers today, they talked about the future generations, and that's what our focus is on, that our ancestors fought, that they struggled for this land, the Diné, they marched hundreds of miles before Sumner on the long walk, and now we are here, and we are fighting for the peaks, that we want to struggle for the peaks, because our ancestors didn't struggle for nothing. They did not do what they had to do to protect the land, the culture, and the language. And we are here today to protect this for our future grandchildren, for the future children of the next coming generations. You look at the peaks now, it's still natural, it's still beautiful. Just a few stars from the Arizona Snow Bowl, from the ski resort. And we want to keep it that way for the next hundreds and thousands of years. If we allow this desecration to happen to the San Francisco peaks, then what's going to become of our people? What's going to become of the Diné, the language, the culture? We've already lost so much, and we cannot lose this, because this is who we are. This is our mother. The mother of the mountain is our mother. It's our grandmother. That's how we look at it. And that with the struggle that's going on, it's a pretty big struggle, and it's been lasting for a few years now. And when I got involved, it was back when Nora Rasher made the decision from the National Forest Service back in March of 2005. I was 14 years old then, and when that came up, I couldn't take it any longer. I had to take a stand. So we formed Youth of the Peaks, and then it went to court when the tribes appealed against it. In October in 2005, it went to the federal court in Prescott, Arizona. And by sometime later on, I can't remember when, but we got the verdict, and it was in favor of the National Forest and for Snow Bowl. So then the tribes, they appealed again, and it made it into the 9th District Court in San Francisco. And last year, in October 2006, it was heard there. And back in about March again, in 2007, we got the verdict, and it was in favor of the tribes. So that was a big, big thing for our tribes. It was a big thing for us, and it made us very proud that we had to struggle for this. But over the summertime, Snow Bowl, they appealed, and now the case is going to be reheard on Tuesday. So as us, as being humans, as us, as being the children of the earth, we can only do so much. And we would really appreciate it if we had a lot of supporters, if our brothers and sisters could come and join us, because once they see, it's important for them to see, because all we ask is for an understanding. All we ask is them to understand that we need to protect this. This is something that is held sacred. This is something that if you allow this to happen, it's going to have a huge impact and a big effect on our Indigenous people. So we ask those to come out and support us. Support your brothers, your sisters, your parents, your grandparents, and most importantly, the future generations, because this is what we can do. But for those who cannot make it, I ask for your prayers, because as us, as being humans, we can only do so much, and the rest is left to the Diné, the spirits, and they're the ones who are going to protect this mountain, that we have to pray to the spirits to keep this balance in mind while we're going through this struggle. So then our land will be happy. So then we can continue to protect it in any ways possible. Because we're already facing enough troubles today from mining, from drilling, from deforestation, all over the world, affecting Indigenous people all over the world. And we need to continue to protect what we have left due to colonization and globalization. We need to protect what we have left as Indigenous people, and we need to protect whatever we have in our hearts, because without our sacred sites, without our language, what's going to become of us? And that's what scares me the most. This is the only reason why I sit before you and I speak in this way. It's because this, as a young person right now, as Youth of the Peaks, we're in this time of our life when we're being molded into what we're going to become as adults. So for us, protecting the sacred site, protecting our culture, protecting these songs and these prayers, it's going to help us become good adults. It's going to help us become the elders that we have now in protecting this language and protecting these ways. So I want to thank everyone out here. It makes me very happy to see that we have brothers and sisters out here who are willing to come out here on a Saturday night and help support. And as being a Diné, as being an Indigenous youth, it gives me that strength to go out there and to continue to protect these sites, to continue to sing the songs and say these prayers every day whenever I can. And I just really want to thank you. And as from my perspective, seeing it through my eyes and seeing the struggle that we're facing, I can't have.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Tesosomo. It is a privilege to be here tonight with such a great group of different folks. The struggle that the South Central Farmers composed in the last four and a half years was initially to protect a piece of land that was dedicated to the land after to the community after the 1992 uprisings in South Central. And it was clearly something that they inadvertently didn't think we were going to take serious. And the community, the majority of the community who were in the 9th district and zip code 9058 constitute about a third of the poor people in LA. About 30% of the community goes hungry every night. There's definitely issues of food sovereignty and food supply. And a project that was developed there was this urban garden, urban farm that we've had there. It had been developed over 14 years. My father was one of the original people who helped to organize that community farm. And it evolved and it was taken care of by the people. And it was managed by the community. And they provided healthy food that was very needed in an area. In 2003, the land, in a very similar situations as we have here, was basically sold to a developer in a backroom deal, and the community was given absolutely no consideration, similar to the same conditions that a lot of our folks on this table have experienced. And Rufina was out in the audience and myself, and we started to ask what the community wanted to do. And the community said, well, we're going to fight. We're going to fight to see how far we can take the struggle. And in the short version of this, the land was sold to a developer for $5 million. And he turned around and said, well, if you want it back, I want $60 million. And the idea was that we couldn't possibly raise $60 million. But we came together as groups of people from different organizations and in the community and abroad and internationally, and we were able to put together $60 million. And since this is a game of poker, we called a bluff, and they backed out on us, and they evicted the community with a large paramilitary force of sheriff's department and police, and basically told us, don't do this again. You're not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to succeed. That would have been the end of it, but we decided that that our resiliency demands a little more. That we are not necessarily interested in the notion of equality, that we're interested in what we need as a community, and whether that comes through our doing, and that was something that we were going to express. It was our collective expression that we wanted to continue of the people that remained with us. And so we started to commute to go farm in Fresno, and we ended up in Fresno. We farmed for a year over there, and then we found something closer in Bakersfield, and then we started farming there. We were actually still farming there. And then by the struggle that we showed to the outside world, we were very fortunate to encounter people who had a good sense of what it was we were trying to do, and they allowed us to purchase land. And right now, I think that some of you may know, but we own, as a community, we own 85 acres of land in Button Willow, California, which is right next to Bakersfield. And this is, to us, we went from 14 acres to 85 acres. We consider that a victory. We'd like it to be in downtown LA, but, you know, we have to do what we can. And as, you know, other elders have said, you know, that, you know, going from point A to point B isn't always a straight line. You know, we may have to take a couple of turns. And so we're very fortunate that, you know, we're proud that we are going to continue to develop our food sovereignty programs that we develop in the community. In the past year, we probably have brought in over 30 tons of organically grown healthy produce that we sell through our monthly tianguis and through the local farmers markets. And I think that one of the things in all of these struggles, and I'm going to quote my sister Rosa Romero from Access of Justice, who said, you know, somebody has to feed the revolution. And I think that we feel that that is something that is very important for our community, is that we've lost all the food diversity that we had, and all of the, you know, the traditional ways of preparing our foods and the kinds of produce that we used to grow. That diversity has been diminished through this process of centralization and agribusiness, that, you know, they grow things in humongous quantities, and there's no room for diversity. There's no room for difference. And one of the things that I think all of our people's value is the value of difference. And I think that that's one of the things that makes our culture very resilient, is our ability to maintain diversity and stock diversity and food diversity, along with other things. And I'm very proud to, you know, share this experience with you, that, you know, the struggles are what we make of them. And, you know, we're here in solidarity with the Save the Peaks Coalition because we truly believe in their work. And, you know, they believed in us when we were in our moment of need. Clay and some of the other people showed up, and they helped out when we were doing our encampment. And, you know, it's, people may not think of a lot of what we actually did, but we expropriated land from the U.S. for 23 days.
Sharing the space with all of you here today. Unfortunately, my coworker Jesus Torres couldn't make it this evening, so I'll be filling in for him. You know, I didn't really understand or have a connection to land until I was able to go back to where my family and where my ancestors came from in the Philippines. And so, you know, going back you know, a few years ago, and seeing and feeling and really understanding what it means to be connected to the land happened for me later on in life. Because I grew up here, I'm a second generation immigrant here in the United States, and so because of systems like colonialism and imperialism, I did not grow up, you know, speaking my native tongue to my parents because they did not want me to learn Tagalog. They wanted me to just be speaking English. And so going back to the Philippines, you know, I felt a deeper connection to who I really was, and specifically seeing the effects of U.S. imperialism back in the Philippines and U.S. military toxic waste in the Philippines and its lasting effects there. That experience is really what politicized me and brought me to the struggle of environmental justice. And so working at Communities for a Better Environment is, it's all a part of the same struggle. And so, you know, for me, learning about the issue that's going on in Arizona with the Save the Peaks Coalition, you know, I really understand that it's all connected to the same struggle that we're fighting for. We're fighting for the preservation of our land, you know, of our culture, fighting against these systems that continue to devalue life, devalue our culture, devalue who we are as a people. And so, you know, some of these things that are central that we think that, well, you know, in the definition of what environmental justice is, you know, everyone has a right to a clean and safe, healthy environment where you live, where you work, where you play, and where you worship. And so a lot of times, you know, that last point where you worship, that isn't being valued. In Southeast Los Angeles, you know, we're continuing to fight against industrial sources of pollution. This is an industrial urban environment. In Southeast LA, we're fighting against a power plant in the city of Vernon that wants to be located less than a mile from our office, less than a mile from six schools. Within a 6 mile radius, there are over 300 schools. And so we're fighting for the quality of the air. We're fighting, you know, for proper land use. You cannot be building these toxic facilities, you know, adding millions of tons of pollution and greenhouse gases into an already overburdened community. And so as I was watching the documentary about the Save the Peaks Coalition and what's happening in those struggles in Arizona, I couldn't help but see the direct connections between what's happening here, what's happening there. You know, the fight against the U.S. Forestry Service not giving access to the Diné people, the Hopi people, or letting people know about public hearings. You know, that's happening here in Southeast Los Angeles, where government agencies are telling us, well, we notified you, but where the notifications and the, you know, the language that is accessible to the people living in that community. A lot of times, this is the case here, this is the case there, whether we're fighting against the U.S. Forest Service, or is it the Air Quality Management District, or the U.S. government polluting communities all over the world. You know, we just need to recognize that these struggles here, it's important to fight for our local struggles, but also important to recognize how all of us are connected, you know, in the work that we're trying to do. I specifically work in the youth program, and we're based in three high schools in Southeast LA, in Huntington Park High School, Southgate High School, and Southeast High School. I wanted to recognize some of them are here today. They're standing in the back. Our youth leaders, I'm really proud to be here speaking, you know, as a representative of Youth for Environmental Justice. You know, we do all that we can to educate the youth in the community, to bring the issues, because a lot of times, like I said, like for me, you know, living in Los Angeles, I didn't feel that connection to the land until I was able to go back to my hometown of the Philippines. And so I feel that we are oftentimes disconnected here in LA. Unfortunately, you know, we don't have green spaces. We don't have as many natural places to go to. And so, you know, and on top of that, You know, the air that we breathe is being contaminated. Corporations that are valuing profits over the people are, you know, continually bringing down our communities. And so I just wanted to say that I'm really honored to be here once again. And, you know, as part of the environmental justice community here in Los Angeles, I definitely support what's going on in Arizona and what's happening worldwide. And so I just encourage all of us to continue fighting and supporting these struggles, and to just, you know, spread the word for, you know, environmental justice and indigenous rights. Thank you.
Or you have a question to the panel, we're going to ask that you come and line up on the right side. They're going to set up a microphone here right now. One of the things that I was talking to some of the organizers the other day about, and sometimes it seems like it's a simple question, but it definitely seems to be the battle, especially when we're dealing with this, you know, dominating law, hegemonic law. The continuing battles of paradigms, different worlds, how we see things. I wanted to ask anybody on the panel, or rather than personally, if you could explain the significance of sacred, because that seems to be the obvious battle of one person seeing this as a bottle of, just a plastic bottle, and maybe somebody else seeing it as something that's a living entity. So I would like to, you know, ask anybody on the panel if you could share that from whatever perspective, from your traditions, or, you know, what the ancestors were speaking through. What is sacred? What is the significance of sacredness to indigenous people?
Developed through life. I look around me and I see all these different sacred things, because everything's alive, from the ground that we walk on to this bottle of water that I hold here. Tol'ina'atek, this water is life. That everything here has been given life, and everything is sacred. So whatever natural beauty there is, it's sacred. The people that sit here are sacred. The ground that we walk on is sacred. And yeah, whatever holds a significant purpose, the ground that we walk on, we have prayers for that. The mountains that are part of our creation, we have prayers for that. The beach to the west, we have a prayer for that. That everything is life. That everything has a significant purpose in our prayers, in our songs. But I think one thing that doesn't have that real purpose is money. And that the things that we use, we hold on to because it's sacred. It has life. Everything that we have is life. And we need to respect it and take care of it.
As my sister here was saying, and I've heard it echoed, especially with our young people, and I'm so proud of you guys, as a 30-year activist in the trenches and veterans of foreign wars, I'm really proud of you guys. When I think of the word sacred, and that's one of those terms that we just don't have a definition that's translatable, but I think of connection and relatedness. That's what's important to us, is that we are related to this, and even to this plastic here, because every product, everything that is around us, we have that consciousness and that realization that it all comes from Mother Earth, that it's valuable. And there's none of us and nothing that is not connected to each other, as our late elder Corbin Harney used to say, one water, one air, one people. We breathe the same air. When you live next door to your neighbor, You're absorbing everything, the same sunlight. All the things that the Western European culture doesn't acknowledge. You know, we try and fragment things, when we try to analyze things, that's what pulls us away from the relationship, the connectedness to that, to those things, when in reality we can't. And even us in our own chaos and our own confusion and living in these types of situations, we even have to go to that point and say, what is sacredness? But it's a relationship to this and to everything and to all of us. And when we, that's where our sovereignty is broken. When the United States government throws us into legal processes, which is not our, it's not our law. When they define what sovereignty is by their criteria, that's removing our sacred relationship to each other. But we have to stay connected, not consumed so much. You know, there's many ways. The notion of wealth, sacredness is measured through wealth. And today, wealth is measured through credit, through money, through consuming, through buying Nikes, through buying cars, when actually the wealth, the sacredness of the wealth was that we had access, we had all of our resources, and it wasn't for us. It was that wealth that we could pass on to the future generations so the earth is sustained, so our people are sustained, all as one.
Tickets at the front door, lots of prizes, tickets for $5, 3 for 10, please try to buy raffle tickets. I want to remind you that this is being presented today by the Axis of Justice Organization as well as the Save the Peace Coalition. Today's event is entitled Defending the Land, Indigenous Cultural Survival, Environmental Justice, and Protecting Sacred Places. Following tonight's discussion, there will be an awareness concert, so please stick around for that. Please state your name and if you have a comment or a question.
Hey, it's John Ewell, Long Beach. My comment is that I see with horror this same problem of a key traditional site, a mountaintop, again being threatened by a ski resort development sitting on quote unquote government land, as in the Mount Shasta struggle in the 1980s. I don't know how we can possibly stop these sort of things from happening, but I would desperately like to see them happen as an environmentalist, European American of privilege, if you will. How can any of us do this? And my question is about the curious resurgence of religion in America nowadays, when you would think that people were bringing religion into the political sphere again, so much in resurgence now don't understand what these mountains mean to Native people, to what sacred places threatened by a horror of all things, or a school expansion mean to the Native people who have lived here and kept what care of this land for generations before an European American showed up? And what, in answer to that question, how can we, as people, help you, help all of us together turn the corner and realize that, hey, these sacred places really are special and they need to be kept sacred for all time?
I'd like to offer some thoughts on that. As I listen to everybody here, I hear the end of history. And within the end of history, and the end of history in the sense of how we are engaged in this social production, the social engine that we participate in. And this end of history is an inconvenient reality for the construction of the sovereign individual and, you know, the autonomy that we theoretically are supposed to be given for the means of being able to individuate us. I don't mean individuate us, but to individuate us, to divide us. Because it's only through that process, and the process that we can be broken down and subdivided, that we lose the kind of collective power that we have. Great examples for us is, you know, what we were able to do with the South Central Farm as a group of people, not as one individual person or several individual people, but those kinds of masses or configurations are inconvenient. They're hard to digest. They're erratic. They're irrational. They don't follow their rules. And within this situation, this isn't a process that is new. This is a process that has been going on for, in the case of our people, for 500 years. You know, we went through the first wave of being deterritorialized and being removed from our land, and we're just going through different waves of that same continual process. I was watching a video where people in Canada, you know, ordinary colonized people are being deterritorialized because they want the oil that is under their houses. And there are waves of people that that's happening too. And in the Amazonian, where they're planting eucalyptus trees for toilet paper, you know, masses of people are being deterritorialized. The climate change is affecting people who live on these shallow islands, and they're being, you know, displaced, and we're being, it's the same theme, it's just different waves of it. And so what we're coming up against is, you know, how do we resist, and how do we create a different path out of these waves that keep coming at us? You know, it's always going to be one side, another side. Why? Because these things are inconvenient for the means of production that we're engaged in. And so the challenge for us is, you know, how do we express our resiliency as people and constitute different ways of surviving? And to me, that's the fundamental question that I, you know, that we as a group, as an accessible farmers, have been trying to deal with, is how do we constitute an alternative way of surviving while maintaining our dignity, our equally, you know, our religious expressions, our beliefs, are inconvenient realities that get in the way of being individuated and being, you know, over, you know, being consumed by the same system that we're engaged in. Right now.
Remember the land that you're on. This is Los Angeles, okay? Our ancestors are from here. Just because it's an urban area doesn't mean that it's... Don't individuate yourself from the land. Wherever you go, honor those ancestors. That's the first way that we gain our strength and our power as indigenous people, and as we all come from indigenous people, to fight these situations. Second of all, the way that we stop a lot of this is by stop consuming. Why are the San Francisco peaks in jeopardy right now? Because skiers are there. They want to be there. It's a consumption. Why do we have the problems at Pawnee and these places? It's because more people are coming. They want more roads to drive more cars. The more we consume, the more is manufactured. And then every time something's manufactured, Swiffers or whatever, little convenience things, the more degradation to the planet. Why do people need toilet paper? Where does it come from? Silly things like this. In the Amazon region, the people are suffering because of our consumption here. We have to stop consuming. We have to think with that, which you said, food sovereignty, is that the term you use, Thistle? Produce places here to be sustainable. Do not individuate yourself from the land. Learn to grow. Sever yourself from consuming, and then we can begin to fight the system in this process. It's hard. We all part of it. I'm part of it too. I flip on a switch too. It's so important.
The United Nations General Assembly passed the Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I was wondering, with Indigenous people's struggles, so maybe you could talk about this instrument and how it can be used to fight current struggles and any struggles around the corner.
Thank you.
How's it going to help? I was on this panel speaking. It was an amazing thing because the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is one of the oldest declarations that has been worked on actually by Indigenous peoples, and it was one of the oldest declarations at the United Nations. And the first time presented to the United Nations, it didn't get passed for the reasons of some places in Africa and other places that were doing and mining for diamonds, and you know, all this stuff. They didn't want to pass it because what the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is that it's like, in a sense, a backing. And so for it to have passed, it was an amazing victory for Indigenous peoples all around the world, because it is through things like that that are, you know, so to say, more official, and you have the power and the baggage of a thing like the United Nations, and you have more of the world and the media looking upon those things. I think it really, really helps. I haven't been too much in the loop with the things, so I'm not really exactly sure what has been happening so far, but I was so excited, and it was just a very, very big step for Indigenous peoples all around the world to start being recognized and start having their human rights violations and abuses being recognized and put to a stop.
You want to comment on that, please?
One of the interesting things about globalization has actually something to do with this very basic idea about legal rights or jurisprudence. I have hard issues with the us being given rights. Nobody give you anything. And in this sense, we are running up against, we used to have this notion of a state sovereignty, and as we are moving into a different mode of production with this terminology of globalization, we're encountering that, you know, these things don't hold the same way. You know, that we're seeing some of this actually being played out in the politics today, that, you know, who really has, you know, sovereignty over what? And as we see the migration of capital, the migration of the means of production over borders, the only thing that can't move are the people. And so in this sense, this is the law is entering an interesting situation where it finds itself in a problem, because the notion of sovereignty is actually being transcended. And how do you deal with this in a global space? And this is, I think, one of the big problems that, you know, our lawyer who defended us, Dan Stormer, was, you know, when he sued Unicalum in South Asia. It was a fundamental problem of, you know, where do you apply the laws to a global entity? And I think that we're going to be seeing many more of these problems. I think the same problems within South America, where they wanted to, you know, take over people's water. This was Bechtel trying to buy people's water and having that be mediated completely. We're going to see a lot more of these problems because, you know, everything else can transgress the law except people.
I'm with a group called 5500 Indigenous Elder Support Committee, and we support all struggles of Indigenous people, traditional Indigenous people that fight for people's rights, not just old people. I participated at the Sundance in that big mountain at the survival camp. And I guess one of the things that we need to know that the struggle up there at the San Francisco Peaks and in the Dene Nation, right, is hooked up with a lot of other struggle, right? The struggle at Big Mountain, the Sundance is all about. There's also the whole issue with Northern Arizona, and Dene, and My question to the panel is that traditional people are being attacked all over the world, just like people, generally speaking, are being attacked all over the world by American corporations in the first place, but corporations just generally speaking. And the left, right, we call that imperialism. And it's the U.S. government, right, that backs their ass up. And so overseas and at home is the same damn thing. Okay, what I want to ask the panel is that in different parts of the world, i.e. in Nepal, Peru, right, the Philippines, people have taken up armed struggle to defend themselves and protect their rights, right? You're talking about the issue of self-determination. Nobody's going to give that to you. Nobody's going to give it to us. We've got to stand up like we're free. If we don't act like we're free, we'll never be free. That's what Fanon and Fanon are. Right? So, I think what I'd like to do is, you know, just pose a question to put it into a different kind of mindset, right? That we can't go around asking a man to be nice, you know? Screw him, he ain't gonna be nice. He's never been nice, right? That's American history. So we need to deal with that. And, you know, if that ain't the mindset we're gonna have, then what kind of mindset do we want, right? I think that's what we need to discuss, or what I feel like we need to discuss. Because, hey, if we go into their box, then they're going to call the shots. And then it's a crapshoot, right? And, you know, you go to the gambling joint, right? Who wins, right? You play it long enough, we always lose, right? So I think that I'd like to bring that up to people, right? In different parts of the world, like, people are standing up and people are kicking his ass. So that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Yeah, boo.
I want to comment on that as well, because for me as a young person, like, all around the world, I'm seeing young people raising their voices on the bar, on the environmental and human rights levels, and, you know, really raising their voices and really taking the responsibility for the decisions that are being made today, because it is us that is going to be inheriting what decisions are being made today. And so it's, people always ask me, oh, it must be so hard to be doing what you're doing and stuff, but for me, being 17, I'm able to use my teenage rebellion in a positive way and be rebellious against failure. And I go to Peru and I'm rebelling and I'm fighting against those oil companies that are dumping 800,000 barrels of toxic waste in one day, containing lead, cadmium, and other heavy metals into the local rivers, which is the communities surrounding the oil drilling places' only resource for water. So.
I also want to comment back on that. I myself am also 17. I started to struggle when I was about 13, 14, around that area. And that this is a harsh time, and a lot of youth are speaking out. In the area that we're from, it's a border town off the reservation, and it's very difficult because a lot of our Native youth aren't encouraged to speak out. We're told to keep quiet. We're told to just sit there and just take in this colonized education. But with this struggle, a lot of our Native youth are finding their voices. So when you look at all these different companies, when you look at Snowball, do you think the youth of Snowball are going to continue this fight? Because once they see another dollar bill go up, they're going to go running after that one, and who's going to continue their fight? As us, as Indigenous youth, we're speaking out. We're doing what we can. We're practicing our culture. We're learning the Western ways of law. And that's how we're going to continue to take care of this land. So the elders out there, we're doing this for the elders because they've struggled. And that now,
We have this new Western education coming in, and we're able to learn these ways. We're able to learn the law process. So all I can say is that as being a youth, we can do what we can, because when we started this struggle, a lot of people didn't believe in us. But once they heard how powerful our voices were, when they saw the effect that we have on people, on our elders, when they look at us, a lot of them say, I'm proud of you. Because when we were growing up, we were told to be silent. Because they were put into the boarding school setting where if you spoke your language, you were disciplined. So, and now, because then they weren't able to be as outspoken because of punishment. But now, as us, we have the privilege to speak out, and our elders are coming up to you and saying that they're proud of us. So all I can say is that us now, in the future generations, we're going to continue the struggle to protect these ways. We're going to continue to do what we can to protect these lands, because our elders fought for it, our ancestors fought for it. And we're going to struggle to protect what we have for our coming generations.
I want to add one more thing. Mo Nishina, this is one of our elders here in this Los Angeles community. Gloria Arianas is another. Veterans of Foreign Wars, huh? Okay? There's a lot of people in this audience. We're the old timers. We're the ones back in 1970s, late 70s. We weren't afraid to go up against a man. And I'm not saying these youth are. We need to pray for these young people so that they're protected bodily, their spirit, so they're strong. Look to the models in LA, what people are doing, what Tezo, the South Central farmers, have done, how they struggle, how Mo has inserted in the middle of the city, in urban chaos and insanity, how we move, we maneuver through the city as sovereign people. Nobody will confine our spirits or our bodies. The man can't do that. They can take our lives. But you know what? I got 4 kids and 2 grandkids. And we all have that sovereignty. We need to think and move as sovereign people. We are building models, just as this young woman on the end, she was talking about the work they're doing. These young people are building models of how to do this. So let's continue to create these spaces for healing and for growth of these kinds of projects. We have to keep going. We can't let them stop us.
Another comment on this issue is that when we were deciding to struggle with the South Central farmers, that was a very interesting question that we'd had to deal with many different groups, was the issue of resisting with force. And to me, as I understand it now, to fight power with power only constitutes a bigger power response. And I want to use an interesting example that I learned about a different kind of resistance. And this was the fall of the USSR. The fall of the USSR did not happen through the process of the USSR being threatened on their sovereignty. There was no threat on their sovereignty. The USSR fell from within. It fell because the people refused the care of the system that was constituted. And it seems kind of, how is it that simple? If we refuse to be taken care of, if we refuse to be mediated, can we constitute a different reality, a different assertion of the real for us? And I think that for me, I found that this is what works for us, is to refuse. One of the things when we got evicted right away, people were saying, "Oh, let's do a fundraiser so we can, get you guys, buy you guys food, or get people to give you food." And that isn't what we're fighting for.
We're not being fighting to switch from one caregiver to another caregiver. We're fighting to constitute our own food supply, our own food sovereignty. That's what we're fighting for. And we're not going to get it by being mediated by one more group, even if it's a benevolent group, you know? And in that sense, I think that, the first thing that we have to do, and this is what Cindy was saying, we have to refuse. We have to refuse.
I don't have a question, I just have something I want to say. I'm a mother, and I remember to everyone that's in this room, I want to speak my heart. I'm honored to meet all of you, to hear your words, and to know that you are here together. And I just want to encourage people who pray, like I do, to pray for everything that they've spoken, those things that they have said to us and to share. And that is what I want to do. I just want to encourage others. And I ask that you pray for me as well. Thank you.
I'd like to say something related to that. I want to thank the woman who came up for her intention. And I want to say how strong our intentions are. You know, how strong it is that we all came here. Yeah. We all came here because we know we're connected. We all came here because we know that the land is sacred. And I want to say that the 11th, even though we can't, those of us who can't be there, that the power of our intentions, you know, the power of our prayer, that we can hold, you know, and be strong and stand with the people who are there at the court gate, you know. And so that's what I'd like to ask all of you for on the 11th, that we hold, you know, we hold it as a day of prayer. We hold it that we are supporting the Peaks Coalition, you know, and that's something that we can do no matter how busy we are with our own private life. So I want to remind us that our intention, you know, that our intention that we're talking about here as a group, you know, as we witness it, that we're changing the world, that we're remembering, you know, and that the possibility, you know, it's so inspiring, these young people. So, and there are more of them. These are just two of them. You know, I feel better. I'm going to be taken care of as an elder. You know, look at them. There's no stopping them. So, on the 11th, we'll be praying. We'll be standing together as a group.
Just think of these declarations as kind acts, because there's been many declarations, there have been many treaties. For the people that I represent, people, Gaguana, Vietes, Olokowi, these are all very sacred sites for us. And yet those very same people desecrating those sites. The UN gave us many, many declarations. UN Declaration 1214, the right for the Puerto Rican people to determine their own destination. Declaration 1316 of the UN Charter, the right to Puerto Ricans to determine their own sovereignty. Even if it meant armed struggle. So how do you navigate this beautiful struggle that we are engaging right now to save the peace. I also was a supporter at Big Mountain for many years, for 4 years, not many. And I saw what I will never forget. So how do you navigate in the work that we're doing, knowing that these declarations and that these treaties are just a bunch of lies, you know, and how do we work within that?
Thank you for your questions. I think the best answer to that is to echo what Rebecca just said. And I want to quote an amazing activist in the sacred site protection struggle, Annie Whitehat. She's Lakota, and she's been fighting very hard to protect Bear Butte. And I was fortunate enough to hear her speak once, and she said that the best response that they have is to create a wall of prayer. And that at the end of the day, no matter what happens in the courts, no matter what happens with the false treaties or the declarations that we know will be reneged on tomorrow, and in terms of sovereignty, what you can't take is our prayers. You cannot take that connection that each of us has to our land and to the Creator and to one another. And I firmly believe, you know, it may take 10 years, it may take 100 years, it may take 500 years, but the more of us that can make that profound commitment to ourselves internally and to one another and to our communities to pray and to hold that intention, like Rebecca said, I believe that's really the only and the ultimate solution at the end of it all.
In addition to that, and I want to acknowledge my Taino brother. I know that right now Puerto Rico, they're going through a struggle right now as one of their massive cemeteries is being violated. And Naniki, their elder, is unable to be real active, and we stand there in solidarity with the Taino people. But just also in addition to the prayer is constant with all of us, but also as individuals, as we resist, as we continue to acknowledge everybody's talents and all of our communities, all our placements, and put all of this together. If you work very locally, you don't have to stay at the global level. People are doing that at the global level, and I think this is one of the problems, is because so many people at the local level say, so what is the United Nations? How does that directly affect me? And I'm going to keep saying this because I feel very strongly about this. Look to Los Angeles. This is the Indian capital of the United States. And here we have many, many models as we are functioning as a community of human beings and training to feed the people, not only just the food, the physical food, but the spiritual food and the cultural food. Keep working at the local level. Become active with your children. However, stay active. You're creating. Read Linda Tuhivai's Smith, the Maori scholar, decolonizing methodologies. We're all in the process of decolonizing, of shedding this stuff. Hang on to each other. And prepare. Don't rely on the man. Let's make our own communities. Let's build community for Mother Earth. Woo!